Hey guys, how's things? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, Jacob Hornberger will be here. Oh yeah, I should have wrote up a blog entry and things. I forgot about that. Today's show, Jacob Hornberger. We're going to be talking about the thing coming up this Saturday at LBJ Law School here in Austin, Texas. Jacob Hornberger is hosting the Future Freedom Foundation, and the guests are Ron Paul, Glenn Greenwald, and Radley Balco. And so that's going to be really cool. Obviously, libertarian foreign policy, the libertarian spying policy, and the libertarian militarization of the police policy. That is opposition to these things. And by three of the greats, even though Glenn Greenwald is not a libertarian, he's a liberal. He's really good on the Bill of Rights, and especially, obviously, the First, Fourth, Fifth Amendments. So that's going to be good. If I can remember to check the right box here. And, yeah, so that's going to be really cool, man. Obviously, as you probably all well know, the biggest Ron Paul fan on the face of the earth. Love that guy. Absolutely love that guy. So grateful for Ron Paul, man. And for that matter, for Jacob Hornberger. And not just because he helped sponsor this show. yeah, anyway. And also, I'm a huge Radley Balco fan. I have the book and haven't read it. Yeah, it's a likely story, believe me. I have read many, many of his articles back when he was at Cato. I guess he may still be at Cato, but back when he was writing it, you know, exclusively for them, and then he went over to the Huffington Post, which I thought was good, libertarian outreach in the liberal community, and then now he's at the Washington Post, libertarian outreach in the people with power and influence community. Like, hey, man, these cops are too much like soldiers. It's starting to be a problem for your legitimacy, guys. That kind of message. So, yeah, that's pretty good. And anyway, Jacob also is really good on everything. He reminds me of this great article by Murray Rothbard. I know I've said this before on the show, but there's new listeners all the time. They don't know everything I ever said before. And besides, I like it. It's a good point. It's a good compliment to Jacob Hornberger. There's an article by Murray Rothbard where he says, I'll take a radical minarchist over a conservative anarchist. And I think he was picking a fight with Milton Friedman's son, who I don't know too much about. But, you know, I don't know. He had written a book, The Machinery of Freedom, about how it's basically the emotionless, the completely reasonable utilitarian argument for anarcho-capitalism, which I'm sure was probably extremely valuable, you know? But Rothbard is saying, yeah, no, but what about the hatred for injustice? Isn't that why we're here? Don't we hate the state because of the horrible things that they do? And because they're violating the rights that we all believe are at the core of humanity? Yeah. So Hornberger is one of those. He's a constitutionalist. Yeah, yeah, anarcho, this and that. Let me know once we have a constitutional republic how much more we can repeal then. But he's dedicated to this constitution. He just likes to see it enforced. It's not the most libertarian argument, but boy, he sure as hell means it. And so today, of course, we're going to talk about conscription, because he's got an article like that. And we're going to talk about the rise of the national security state after World War II. That's sort of his bread and butter. And he's very good on opposing the welfare state, too, and the regulatory state, and the better mow your lawn or we'll put you in prison or kill your dog or whatever crazy lunatic state. But what happened with the World War that changed America so drastically in terms of the relationship between the humans, the states, the national government, their unlimited authority over us, and the economy, and the people of the planet Earth? So anyway, yep, that's going to happen. And of course, I'm going to give him plenty of time to plug his giant thing that's happening at LBJ Law School. All right. So I guess the big news is, and I really don't want to talk about this at length today, so I'm glad I have very little time left in this segment to discuss it. Today's the day that Rand Paul is declaring his presidential run, and I don't care. Which really sucks, because if you think about that just in the abstract, that you had Ron Paul run the last two elections, and then blam, by the next presidential election, oh, they had to skip one. Oh, yeah, no, they didn't. 8 and 12. And then by the next presidential election, he's got his son lined up, ready to go. Just like Ron, only younger. And a senator. And, yeah, it was not to be. Just too good to be true. And it's been obvious to some of us since 2009. It's taken a little bit longer for others to come around. But the problem is with Rand is that he's who he is. And the thing is, his run for the presidency is going to be a disaster, because he's already set the model, which is try to appeal to everyone with a half-assed sop to your assumption about their beliefs. And so everything that he says is just kind of mush. He doesn't stand for anything. I read a quote of a guy saying, well, I supported his father twice, even though I disagreed with him on quite a few things. I thought, well, there's an honest man. And this time around, I just don't see that about Rand. I guess I'll vote for Ted Cruz, because when Ted Cruz gets up and talks, at least I know that he says what he thinks, which is obviously not true. But at least Ted Cruz, to this guy, pulls that off. He's not so blatantly flip-flopping around all the time, changing his position, and then lying about whether he ever had that previous position. In the age of the petaflop. I mean, are you kidding me? So, I guess there may be some excitement, but I think probably not nearly as much as he is anticipating. And I think a lot of the Ron Paul base, they'll kind of, maybe a lot of them haven't been paying attention for a while. And they'll start out wanting to like him, and they're going to end up like the rest of us. Anyway, there's an article here in BuzzFeed where they just have the quotes from his staff saying, yeah, we haven't decided whether we're going to try harder to throw sops toward the Christian right or the fiscal conservatives. And then as the Twitterer, used to be blogger, Bill Mond put it, none of them are buying anyway. They don't like him anyway. He's not born-again right-wing enough for the born-again right-wingers, and he's not trustworthy enough on fiscal matters, or at least they just perceive him as unelectable, the big business guys. And, of course, it's the same reason so many of us wanted to like him, and or still do, is because of who his father was, what we knew his father stood for, what we know his father stands for. And want to think that just like Alexander Coburn talked about Barack Obama back in 2007, well, it was 2008, at Jacob Hornberger's conference, the Restoring the Republic conference, he said, there's this secret Obama that's just waiting. Once he gets elected, then he's going to reveal himself to be exactly like what I want, or whatever. And how this is just ridiculous. And for anyone who is a man of principle on the left, like Alexander Coburn, who's seen Democrats come and seen Democrats go, he said, look, Barack Obama is Hillary Clinton in blackface. That's all he is. He's just a Democrat senator, just like the rest of them is who he is. Are you kidding me? Hope and change and all this special belief system and this and that. Give me a break. That'll get you about this far over at the Coburn residence. And as a commenter put at antiwar.com today, Rand Paul is just the Barack Obama of the anti-war right. Oh, somewhere in there is the secret Rand Paul, who actually is pretty good, but no, he just keeps getting worse and worse, and he still will. So, I'm over it. Before it ever began. Too bad.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, y'all, Sky here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back. Okay, a little bit more about Rand Paul. God dang it. I can hear you clicking off, but I just got to say it. I've been saying this. I just tweeted out. I'm only quoting my damn self from years ago. Trying to be everything to everyone. He's going to be nothing to nobody. And, you know, Justin Raimondo, when he decides he likes a political figure, man, he falls in like with them hard. And he decided after that drone speech, I guess he didn't listen too closely, but he decided after that drone speech, like, yeah, all right, I like Rand Paul again now. Yeah. And then, boy, he spun for him for a little while, too. Oh, the Russia thing, but it's too cute only by a quarter, not a half. It's all right. Come on, guys. That was Justin. But no, Justin's now over it. And he wrote a thing in the LA Times. It's really good. Of course, Justin's a very talented writer, so of course it's very well done. It's in the LA Times, I'm very happy to say. And it's called Stand With Rand. But where exactly? Because, huh? I don't know. And I guess, you know, my main regret is that, and I've seen this coming for a while, and that kind of that same super slow-mo that you remember car crashes in, that kind of thing, that it's going to be a disaster. And I think I just read this quote of Jesse Benton. Boy, this is your closest ally, huh, Rand? You sure you know what you're doing, dude? Jesse Benton saying at the end of this BuzzFeed article, well, you know, we're not sure if the grassroots types that really love Ron are going to be quite as fired up. And, you know, certainly not if he's only polling at like 4 or 5 or 10%. Yeah, that's right. The thing is about Ron is Ron inspires love, right? There are clips of people hugging Ron Paul and not letting go. And people have to say, okay, come on, let go of him. Come on, dude, it's cool, let go. And the reason, and I know TV says that Ron is Rand's problem. All those true things that Ron Paul says all the time, those are going to make Rand look bad. That's all of their consensus. But the reason that us regular human beings who aren't members of the state or its media, the reason we love him is because he told the truth right to our face. And he was great. You know, it's too bad, especially they cut off the town meetings. His campaign cut off the town meetings thing after they had one where it was just bad audio in there. And it made it seem like he couldn't hear that well or whatever, but he just didn't have a good earpiece for the microphone set up or whatever. He couldn't hear. Too much reverb, too much bass in the or something. He couldn't understand him. But it wasn't like, oh, Ron Paul's old fuddy-duddy going deaf. It was just a bad acoustic kind of a situation was all. But what was great about those things, if you ever look back at the Ron Paul town halls, is there are kids who are throwing real good questions at him. About, you know, the situation between the public and the private universities and this and those subsidies and the blah, blah, blah. And these are questions that he didn't have any kind of rote answer. Oh, you know what I always say. He didn't have one of those. And so he'd have to go, And then he would give a perfect libertarian answer. Like, I bet you that's what Walter Block would have wrote if he tried really hard and wrote it five times to get it just right. To make it as libertarian as it could possibly be. And it'd be good, you know, it was really good. And that's the kind of thing that made people love him. And Ron Paul, people go, oh, John McCain or Ted Cruz, they went to Liberty University. Well, When Ron Paul went to Liberty University, he got 3,000 or 4,000 people. Yeah, that's Jerry Falwell's university. A certain kind of Baptist you're supposed to be afraid of, I guess. Well, and you should be afraid of their politics anyway. Not necessarily them, though. But anyway, so he gave a big speech to them. And then he went across the country and gave a speech at Berkeley. And he had 3,000 or 4,000 people come out to both of them in a row. And I believe it was one day and then the next. May have been 2 days apart or whatever. But anyway, and he did that all across the country. 4,000 or 5,000 kids coming out to see him at giant universities all across the country. And the reason they were there was because, hey, here's a guy who actually knows what the hell's going on around here and is perfectly happy to tell us the truth. Wants only for us to understand the truth. And so they're not all a bunch of Rothbardian purists, voluntarists now or whatever, but many of them are. But they all knew that they were being truthed to. And I don't mean in the kook sense. I mean just, listen, here's how the banking system is making you poorer. Here's why the wars don't need to be fought the way this government's fighting them now, et cetera, or at all. Just come home, et cetera. And what does Rand Paul inspire in anybody? Well, maybe I can get a job working for him. Something. But anyway, I'm sorry to say it's going to be Jeb. And you know what? I'll change the subject now after wasting that whole segment on Rand. Here's about why it's going to be Jeb. Someone said to me, you think? Actually, not one person. Many people have said to me, Jeb? Christ, are you sure? It's going to be Jeb? And then, so here's my answer, and I may be repeating myself, I don't know. But here are the constituencies in American democracy. You'll notice you're not in it. The bankers, the insurance companies, the arms dealers, the pharmaceutical companies, big agribusiness, the old people lobby, which is the pills again, and Israel. They decide who's the president. Those are the constituencies of the American Republic. You notice they're all special interests. Very narrow interests at the expense of the rest of us. And so, yeah, that's how it goes. And Jeb Bush has them all locked up. And there's nobody who's going to take those constituencies from Jeb Bush. Marco Rubio? What? Oh, the people of America are going to... Are they going to use Ted Cruz as the Stop Jeb front? I'll tell you, it's going to be no different at all than John McCain in 2008. 2007 and 8. Nobody likes him. I'm stuck with him anyway. And you could have gone down the list then. Well, Tancredo hates Mexicans too much, so that counts out, big business. Same for Duncan Hunter on China. Romney's a Mormon, so that counts out almost the whole South in terms of turnout right there. And... you know, all the organized Falwell, right? Liberty University types. And Ron believes in peace and integrity and honesty. So can't be him. And so who's left? Oh, get behind the war hero, everybody. The liberal Republican that every Republican voter hates. In fact, they didn't really line up to make sure he stopped Barack Obama, as frightened as they were at the time. They still didn't support him, really, but he was the default. And he was the one who could line up all the major party constituencies, and so it will be with Jeb. And I guess it's true that Jeb could really blow it in just the dumbest way, but nah. All things being equal, that's who we're stuck with. And to think Rand Paul, instead of all this ridiculous president stuff, could be the greatest senator ever, but nah. Then he wouldn't have a chance to still lose and run for president. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. And you'll be happy to know that I got Jacob Hornberger on the line, president, founder and president of the Future of Freedom Foundation at FFF.org, which, of course, helps to sponsor this show. Welcome back. How are you doing, Jacob?
Yeah, good to be back. Doing great. Thank you for having me back on, Scott.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on, and especially for this occasion. Tell them all about the occasion.
Well, we've got a big conference. I mean, it's really turned out to be an exciting event scheduled in Austin for this Saturday afternoon and evening. We've got three of the best speakers in the freedom movement. You got Glenn Greenwald, who I think is maybe the best public speaker in America, at least on issues relating to civil liberties. We got Radley Balco, who's a Washington Post columnist. One of the libertarians that's really had a successful career. He writes on issues relating to the drug war and the militarization of the police. And then we've got Ron Paul, who, of course, needs no introduction, that has inspired just millions of people to favor freedom for our country. And those are our three speakers. We're going to have it at the University of Texas at the LBJ Library on Saturday, free admission. We've already got about 650 people lined up, and so we may be filling the auditorium. It's going to be on a first-come, first-served basis on registration. So anybody that hasn't signed up, come on over and join us. It's going to be a great time.
Cool. Yeah, well, I'm all signed up, so I'll be seeing you there. Bringing the wife with me, too, so that'll be cool.
Awesome, yeah. It's been a while since we got to see each other, but I've never met your wife before, so I look forward to that. And yeah, it should be fun.
I always wanted to get my picture taken with Ron Paul. Maybe I'll have a chance this time.
Yeah, just squeeze your way up there.
Yeah. So I wanted to give you a chance to elaborate on a few of those things there. Of course, Glenn Greenwald is a liberal and not a libertarian, as you know, and he'll fight about that because people accuse him of being a libertarian, of course. But the thing about him is that he's perfect on the Bill of Rights, and I think even including guns, although he doesn't usually talk about that very much or anything like that. But he absolutely is the kind of Jewish lawyer who defends Nazis' right to free speech and means it 100%. And I think you and I spoke before about that debate he did at Cato with the former drug czar, where Glenn just mopped the floor with him, where he is really a force to be reckoned with and has been long before the Edward Snowden and the NSA thing. And so he certainly is. If you define that liberty movement broadly to broadly enough to include him on those points, I sure would be happy to let you include him, because he really has been great for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, clearly he's not a libertarian, because especially on economic issues, he's a liberal progressive. But people often ask us, how come you guys have liberals, progressives at your conferences? Well, we don't have them on economic issues, obviously, but we do have them on issues relating to the national security state, the warfare state, foreign policy. Why? Because these principled liberals like Glenn Greenwald, their positions on foreign policy are the libertarian position. I mean, they're just this clear overlap. Right. And so you've got, as you know, Scott, you got conservatives within the libertarian movement. They call themselves conservatives, but I think they're more like conservative libertarians. They look at us like, wow, you shouldn't be having liberals here. Well, we can't have them, the conservatives that are part of the movement, because they're horrible on foreign policy. A lot of them favor the interventionism, the invasion of Iraq, the war on terrorism. The case that Greenwald makes on these issues is the libertarian case. And that's why we have him, because we want people to hear the libertarian case. Now, he's not the only one. We bring Ron Paul in, who clearly is a libertarian. But there won't be any disagreement between Greenwald and Ron Paul and Radley Balco. I mean, Balco talks about the drug war, and that's the theme of our conference. End the wars on drugs and terrorism. Mm-hmm. Two of the burning issues of our time. I consider them two of the greatest infringements on liberty in the history of the United States. And so you're going to see a clear overlap. And sometimes people say, are you having a debate? No. Everybody's going to be on the same page here. And that's how we carefully vet and select our speakers.
Yeah, well, you really do have the cream of the crop here. And then so that brings us to Balco. I had mentioned about this conference to a friend of mine, or I guess he found it out somehow, said, hey, did you know Ron Paul was coming and this and that? And Balco was the one he hadn't heard of. And when I explained who Radley Balco was, he was pretty enthused about that. That here's a guy who really is the best guy that we have on the militarized police state in the U.S. right now. And he's such a damn good writer and journalist on breaking these stories and following them up and all of that. He's got himself a place at the Washington Post now. And it's not because he sold out and compromised and became a Washington Post guy. It's because he's that good at doing what he does that he even got a spot at the Washington Post. And that's a very important resource that I hope people will look at, and they should know that name.
Yeah, he's a rising star. And the fact that he wrote this book, The Rise of the Warrior Cop, long before this was up in the public eye on the radar screen and public discussion and so forth about the militarization of the police, he was writing this book on it. And so to me, there's no greater authority on the militarization of the police than Balco. I mean, Balco's going to bring this synthesis of showing how the whole national security state, the whole military CIA environment, the constant warfare, perpetual warfare, has seeped down into the police departments. And so now you've got this whole military mindset that's controlling the whole country.
Yeah, I was just reading a quote the other day of a cop saying, yeah, it's just like in Iraq. And they're saying, no, it's not just like Iraq. But then, yeah, it is, I guess. As long as the cop feels that way about it, he makes it true in a Heisenberg certainty kind of a way. All right, and now, so who's this Ron Paul guy?
Well, I tell you, Ron has been one of my real heroes in life. I mean, it's just incredible what he's done, and I think everybody knows that, you know, when he ran that first time for president, when he engaged in that presidential debate where they talked about why the terrorists had attacked on 9/11, and they were all the other candidates were bringing up this nonsense of, oh, they hate us for our freedom and values and so forth. And Ron just hung in there and said, hey, they came over here to kill us because the government's been over there killing them. And, you know, I heard him say later that he thought that was the end of his campaign. But that was really the start of his campaign. People recognize here's a man telling the truth. He's got the courage of his convictions. And he's hung in there on foreign policy, and it's been great. I mean, we link to his articles every week in our FFF Daily newsletter. And then it's not just foreign policy. I mean, he's fantastic on economics. You know, he's one of the earlier ones that was saying abolish the Fed. And he's been a proponent of Austrian economics for, you know, umpteen years. Now, you know, we won't be getting into that at the conference, but that's certainly, you know, he's a libertarian through and through. I mean, he's a real, just what a heroic person.
Yeah, that's what I think, too. Really, you know, Anthony Gregory used to say, Ron Paul makes Thomas Jefferson look like James Madison. You know, which, you know, Anthony, he parses these things very carefully. And yeah, no, he really is right that all the founding fathers have some real fatal flaws in their person, in their deeds, in some of the things that they said that he is not burdened with at all. I mean, he really is all of the best parts of Jeffersonianism without all of Jefferson's baggage at all. And he's the most American of America's legislators that we've ever had, I think. But
yeah,
maybe that's
no,
just me.
When the history of liberty is written, he will certainly be at the top as far as those who helped bring it about.
Yep. All right, now we got to take this break. We'll be right back with Jacob Hornberger to talk a little bit more about this national security state he's relentlessly attacking. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hang tight.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys. Now, I'll save it till the next segment. Sorry, I'm watching the Rand Paul speech. Let's not talk about that. Jacob, what is this national security state that you are always claiming is an alien grafted on extra... an unnecessary or worse part of the American government, as though it's not just part of the American government. What is it that you're really trying to get at there?
Yeah, this, I consider this to be the biggest mistake in the history of the United States, was the grafting onto this national security state to America's governmental system. And it was done. It was so revolutionary, and yet it was done without even the semblance of a constitutional amendment, which is the process by which the citizenry are authorized to alter the original form of government. I mean, if we go back to the original republic that was founded, we see what the mindset of the framers was. And really most Americans, maybe 99% of Americans, there was a deep antipathy to standing armies. And you can see the quotes. We have them on our website at fff.org by people like Madison that just said, look, standing armies are your biggest threat to liberty. And because of what their potential is in terms of oppressing people, and we see that time and again. We see in Egypt right now where there's a military dictatorship oppressing people. And so the founding fathers were against that. Now, there was a basic military force. We know that, a basic army. And they got into a lot of skirmishes. They did a lot of bad things, no question about that. But in relative terms, like when you compare it to, say, World War I or World War II, I mean, the casualties are very small, with the exception of the Civil War. But if you look like the Mexican War, casualties are relatively light. So I'm not suggesting that there wasn't some wars and military skirmishes and the War of 1812 and so forth. But there was just a basic standing military force who's and then if you look at the foreign policy of the American people, that was demonstrated by John Quincy Adams' speech to Congress on the 4th of July, 1821. It's called In Search of Monsters to Destroy, where he says, look, the foreign policy of this country as envisioned by the framers and the founding fathers is that the United States does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. And a lot of monsters, tyrants, civil wars, oppression, starvation, famine, but our government is not going to go over there and fix those. And let's keep in mind also that there was open immigration, where the message was that, look, we're not going to send troops to bomb you and save you. But if you can get out, you have a place you can come to, and we won't forcibly return you to your country. Well, okay, so we see the seeds of that abandonment coming up to like 1898, where the Spanish-American War, the U.S. assumes the role of the Spanish Empire with the aim of taking control over Cuba and the Philippines. And then we see entry into World War I, which was a total abandonment of that philosophy of non-interventionism and total waste of American life. It accomplished nothing. And then you got World War II, which is really a continuation of World War I. But the big watershed then takes place in the aftermath of World War II, and this is the revolutionary transformation. In prior wars, there was always a demobilization where, okay, we fought this war, big government came, but we're laying off the troops, we're discharging them, sending them back in the private sector. That didn't happen. Instead, we end up with a giant standing military, huge military establishment, permanent military establishment, to fight the so-called Cold War against America's World War II partner and ally, the Soviet Union. And so that began the big communist scare about how the communists are coming to get us. And then on top of that, you bring the CIA into existence, which was really an outgrowth of the OSS in World War II, which is this secret intelligence agency that has the power to affect regime changes, coups, assassinations, and MK Ultra, you know, medical experiments on Americans, hiring of Nazis. I mean, it was a totally alien form of government that America had never seen before. And, I mean, this is what totalitarian countries had, this kind of apparatus. And it was all justified. This revolutionary change was because the communists were coming to get us, which was absolute nonsense. But Americans were deferring to authority. They trusted government. Well, by the time Eisenhower comes along in 61, he's leaving office, he gives his farewell address where he says, look, this is an alien form of government apparatus. He called it a military-industrial complex. And he says, this is entirely new to America, and it was. And he says, and it's a grave threat to our democratic processes and our liberties, and it is, and it continues to be. They're bankrupting us for one thing. But now they have the power to assassinate Americans, the power to round up Americans, to torture Americans. I mean, this is not consistent with a free society, Scott.
Yeah, see, that's the thing of it is, we're all younger than that. And so we've all known this. You know, I was born after Vietnam and raised on, I guess I'm kind of lucky to understand war as in through like Catch-22 eyes growing up, because I was born pretty much right after that war ended. And everyone was so jaded by it. But still, I mean, the basic assumption is aim high, Air Force, and be all you can be in the Army every Sunday at football. That's what they tell you. And everybody seems to agree, right? Everybody's dad, everybody's coach, everybody's everything knows it. That's just the way it is. That's, you know, 40% of your choices on a career or a job once you leave high school is go and join and become a man in the service and protect your country and all that. It's so built in. Can you really separate it from what really is Americanism now? Or, I mean, is it fair to say it's alien anymore when it's kind of devoured whatever was the Republic?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's just as alien that we can say it's just as alien as the welfare state is. The notion that government should take care of people with welfare state programs, it's possible to repeal those programs. The crown jewel is Social Security. It is possible to repeal these things. Is it difficult because so many people are on the dole? Of course it's difficult, but nothing's impossible. And the same thing with this idea of a huge military establishment, empire of bases overseas and so forth. But you're right. The propaganda machine has been so successful, especially since the fiasco in Vietnam, where 58,000 American men died for nothing. Again, they said the communists were coming to get us if they didn't go into Vietnam. Well, they lost the war, and the communists never came to get us, so it shows that it was just a lie. But it is possible for people to reexamine the role of government in society, and I know there's differences among libertarians as to what that role should be, but at a very minimum, I think we can all agree that a legitimate role is not involved with having these totalitarian apparatuses, and it is possible to dismantle them. If enough people decide, hey, we want to restore a republic, we want to get rid of this empire, for example, it's not that difficult to all of a sudden start closing military bases overseas and bring the troops home from Korea, bring them home from Germany, bring them home from the Middle East, from Africa, Latin America, and discharge them. And then once that process starts, people can say, oh, okay, now I can understand that, why we shouldn't have troops all over the world like that. Now let's start examining here in the United States. What do we need all these bases here in the United States for? I mean, are they like forts that are protecting the cities from
Comanche.
Some kind of a, huh?
The Comanche.
Exactly. I mean, that's the way I really look at these bases here in the United States. They're like forts to protect us from the Comanches and the Apaches and so forth.
They really are is they're basically there to prop up towns like Killeen outside of Fort Hood, which really, you think about why Fort Hood's there, I'm pretty sure that's not about Indians. That's about being 100 miles from the capital of Texas in case they ever think they're going to secede again. But you have an entire town, a huge town, really, Killeen, that is just entirely, 99% subsidized by the military base there.
Well, that's what's really fascinating is how they have accomplished this by having, Eisenhower called it the military-industrial complex, by having these contracts for the development of weapon systems in every congressional district across the country. And then they have military bases in every state so that then if anybody starts to make waves about, hey, look, we got to cut spending, we're going to bankruptcy and stuff, that everybody can mobilize to save the projects in their district. I mean, it's really a welfare dole. It's no different from Medicare and Medicaid and farm subsidies, Social Security, the whole shebang. It's military largesse. And so you're right. These cities, they panic if you start thinking about, oh, well, let's close the Fort Hood, or, man, all of a sudden everybody starts having a panic attack. And it shows you how dependent people have become on this military largesse. The situation's no different in principle in Egypt, where the military dictatorship controls most economic activity there. I mean, that's why they're so poor. That's why they're having such a hard time. And people keep looking to the dictatorship to solve the economic problems. It's the dictatorship that is the problem.
Right.
And
you know, that's why
token,
I always
yeah.
ask you the same thing when I bring you on this show, because and I think this is why you're always writing the same thing, to just make people understand, to just break through. It's almost, not that you don't get into details, you certainly do, but you always boil it down to just this separate entity that was somehow created by Congress and could be abolished again, and that, how the separateness of the national security state from a constitutional system of a republic and a rule of law. And you say it in such a way where I imagine that people hearing it for the first time really understand. I think it's really important that people have a chance to have it spoken so clearly that, look, the DOD, the CIA, and all of them, we don't need them. No, really, we don't. And people have just never heard anyone say that before, Jacob. That's the thing about it.
You are absolutely right. And you grow up thinking this is a free country because I'm an American and I know that as an American I'm free. And therefore, this governmental system is a free country. It provides, it keeps me safe and so forth. No one sits there and questions that things have changed. This is why it was so significant on both what Roosevelt did in the 30s, where he had this welfare state revolution, but made it look like he was saving free enterprise, when really it was an abandonment of the principles of free markets. And then the same thing in the 40s, where they made it look like it was just a continuation of what had gone before. And so people that are born in that period of time, they grow up with it, they're taught that they're free. And once people start questioning, oh, okay, now I see why America is involved in these perpetual crises. Oh, now I see, yeah, that came into existence in the Cold War. Well, the Cold War is over. Why do we need that? Why can't we repeal the National Security Act of 1947? Why can't we repeal the Espionage Act of 1917 or so? And start, all of a sudden, you start abolishing the CIA and the NSA and the Department of Defense. And you start looking at countries like Switzerland, whose foreign policy America was founded on. I mean, that's where we got the ideas for our constitutional republic. They depend solely on defense in their country. And so all of a sudden people start saying, oh, now I see what he's saying, that we don't need this big apparatus. It's anti-freedom. And then all of a sudden we start moving toward a free society again.
Right. All right. Well, listen, so that's why I'm so appreciative of what you do. I mean, you're really normalizing what should be the basic assumption of everyone in this society. You're doing a lot to move that forward. And what you're doing this Saturday, of course, is a huge part of that. And so for anybody in Texas, I don't know if anybody farther away than Texas can get here, because Texas is pretty big. Any Texans want to come on out, it's at the LBJ Law School this Saturday at UT, right there at 26th Street, Dean Keaton, and what, Trinity or San Jacinto, or right around there. Anyway, just off I-35 on Dean
Keaton.
Yeah,
it's actually at the LBJ Library, not at the law school.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, they're right next door to each other anyway. You'll see the signs, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, but yeah, no, thank you for correcting me on that. The library there. So then that'd be on Red River, I guess. Closer to the freeway. All right. Thank you. That's 1 o'clock Texas time here in Austin at the LBJ Library. Look forward to seeing you there again, Jacob.
Hey, can't wait to see you, Scott. You're one of my heroes too, man. So keep up the great work.
All right. Appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
See you there.
All right, y'all. So Ron Paul, Radley Balco, and Glenn Greenwald. Jacob obviously is putting the thing on the Future Freedom Foundation. That's at fff.org. And we'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for Liberty.me. The social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
Yeah, this Rand Paul thing is already a catastrophe.
Right there in the break between segments of that Hornberger interview, I was reading the closed captioning for the hearing impaired on my C-SPAN. As he still wouldn't take a firm position on Iran. He said he would support a deal that guarantees against Iran's ambitions. Well, what in the hell does that mean? Is their capability to produce weapons-grade fuel and make bombs out of said fuel if they were ever to make it? That's the question. So he refused still to take a position on the damned Iran deal. In his "I'm running for president as your leader" speech. "I am decisive. I will protect us at 3 a.m. I know what to do. I refuse to be nailed down about whether I support a deal for Iran's nuclear program or don't I. Only Congress can decide, not the president." This guy. And then the part I didn't read in the closed captioning, but I see all over Twitter, is where he said, I swear to God, he said, according to the tweets from the news people, "The enemy is radical Islam." In fact, even better than that was, "Until we name the enemy, we can't win the war." Right? Stop calling it terrorism, the war on terrorism. That's just a tactic. We've got to be more specific. Radical Islam. What? So, you mean the harder somebody believes in Islam, the more they want to explode? Is that it? "I believe in Islam so much that bang!" That's what it is, see? Yep, nope, has nothing to do with consequences. Just like he said about war. He said, "I'm against nation building. We can bomb the hell out of them. But stop pretending that it's for their own good." So where his father said, "Stop bombing people and stop wasting money rebuilding their countries after you bomb them. Just knock it off already." Rand says, "Well, bomb them, but then don't bother rebuilding anything." Okay. Great. You could see how they did the math on that one. Well, what we'll do is we'll just cut out half the argument, the decent part. Right. Like, that'd be the worst thing that America ever did, would be to pay reparations to the innocent victims of their aggression. That's the real bad part of this. And we kill hundreds of thousands of people and mean them well the whole time. That's a real waste of spirit on our part. Enough of that. And then the thing about radical Islam is that he's lying and he knows he's lying. The reason that America has terrorist enemies, as you just heard Jacob Hornberger paraphrasing his father in interview last a few minutes ago, is that American foreign policy is the problem. That when the politicians, all the rest of the Republican candidates for president in the debate, said that they hate us because of how good we are, and so their evil is just attracted to us like a north and a south seeking magnetic pole. He said, no, it's the foreign policy caused this problem. We've been bombing Iraq for 12 years. Not five. What are you talking about? This is them carrying out revenge against us for what we did. Not that the Iraqis did it, but, you know, it was because America kept bases in Saudi Arabia from which to bomb Iraq and blockade Iraq and starve and murder 500,000 kids. According to the UN enforcers of the blockade, the no-fly zone bombing on average every other day, including bombing on a Saturday when the House of Representatives was to begin debating articles of impeachment against him. He started bombing Iraq and bombed him for 2 or 3 days and said, okay, now you can start holding hearings on impeaching me. Nice politics. Yeah, that was it. And the Secretary of State gloating on TV that, yeah, we think the price is worth it. Seriously, who cares about more dead kids than died at Hiroshima? If it's what we have to do for Saddam Hussein to still not be driven from power, then seriously, don't bother me, Leslie Stahl, answered the Secretary of State of the United States of America. That's why they hate us, the murders and the deaths. Scheuer had his, I'm laundering the truth through Michael Scheuer, right? Conservative CIA guy relaying to you what the big bad Muslim said. He said, we're doing it to you because you support our dictators. You have your bases in our countries. You use those bases to bomb and blockade the poor Iraqi people to death. And you use your pressure on our kings to keep our oil price artificially low. And you don't give a damn, and or you support the Russians, Chinese, and Indians in their wars against Muslims, which just proves what bastards you are and why we need... Oh, and Israel. Did I leave out Israel? And you support Israel and their permanent occupation, at least at that time, of Lebanon and, of course, of Palestine. The Golan Heights, I don't know if they ever mentioned the Golan Heights, but factually, the Golan Heights, the West Bank, the... East Jerusalem, which is in the West Bank, but anyway, and the Gaza Strip, and the horrible cruelties that the Israelis unleash on their occupied helots, as they have for generations. That was what he said. And the only thing Islam has to do with it is just solidarity. It's just the same way you get your hackles up when you hear that Christians are being killed by Al-Qaeda guys in Syria. You go, well, I never cared about them before, but... And if they're a Syrian, they're hardly a human at all. That's so far away, and their skin's probably brown, and so they're like alien species to me. What do I care? But you say they believe in Jesus too, huh? Okay, I guess I'm a little bit bothered if you need me to be a little bit bothered to support more war over there. Okay. Same kind of thing, see? Solidarity. Let's go join up and fight them. Just like America brings a September 11th or so every week or month, at best, to the people of the Middle East, they get traumatized by stuff like that. And there's a whole war from the 1990s all the way through. It was the proto-Al-Qaeda guys from Egyptian Islamic Jihad that murdered the fascist Nazi pro-Greater Israel rabbi Kahane in 1989. And he was actually a fascist as defined by the Israeli Supreme Court. So, And anyway, but they murdered him, and that was the first real Al-Qaeda attack in America, if you read A Thousand Years for Revenge by Peter Lance. And they had a whole war against us, the World Trade Center plot, along with the Holland and Lincoln tunnels and the UN building. And there was attacks at a couple of places in Saudi Arabia, including the embassy and the Khobar Towers attack in 1996, the embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya, 1998. There was an attempted attack on a U.S. destroyer that failed because the dinghy sank because they put too much explosives on it. And then there was the successful USS Cole attack, which, not that successful, didn't sink the ship, but still killed, I think, another 19 people or somewhere right around there. And then the attempted attack at LAX that got busted at the border in the year 2000 as well, during the millennium and all that. Anyway. So, yeah, none of them said that I believe in Islam so much I got to attack the Americans for being good and decent people who always are nice to everybody, but who let their daughters wear miniskirts to vote it in primary elections, and I just can't stand that. Sitting in my cave thinking they're watching Skinamax on Friday nights. Why, that's sinful. I'm going to blow you up. That's what Rand Paul would have us believe. Bad, bad, sinful American infidels.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Yeah, see, here's the thing. I'm sorry, I got off on a couple of tangents and stayed there. The point is, all the Republican hawks are going to be calling Rand Paul, Hillary Clinton, this whole time anyway, as though she's a dove and he's like her. Instead of, yeah, that's exactly my same accusation against him, too, is that she's a hawk and he's like her. But not a dove, a hawk, though. See, is the difference. But they're going to be attacking him as weak and whatever anyway. But how's he going to win an argument with one arm tied behind his back? He ain't going to tell the truth at all. Yes, I concede every point of fact to you about the danger to America. I'm just not willing to do anything about it. That's how he's going to run for president? The enemy is radical Islam. Come on. And look how easy it would be, as long as he didn't go off on a tangent, to just say what I just said. Look, everybody knows that George Bush Jr.'s father, George Bush Sr., got us into this mess by bombing the hell out of Iraq from bases in Saudi Arabia and staying there. And then Bill Clinton doubled down and made it work, doubled down, and made it worse, and you know, provoked all this Al-Qaeda terrorism against us. Then when September 11th comes, we go and pretend like that's the first day in history, and we go and we do, you know, Bill Clinton's genocide times 10 over there, and turn the whole Middle East upside down. And then Barack Obama comes in and actually takes the side of the Mujahideen, spreading the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and Ansar al-Sharia's war against Muammar Gaddafi 2,000, 3,000 miles to the west, where it then blows down into Mali and into Nigeria. And then he turns around and does the same damn policy in Syria, supporting Jabhat al-Nusra, which ends up breaking off into creating the ridiculous Islamo-fascist caliphate of George Bush's pretend propaganda, made up by Karl Rove and the White House Iraq group. Tell them there's going to be an Islamo-fascist caliphate. They made it. Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, Bush Jr., Barack Obama made the Islamo-fascist caliphate of Osama bin Laden's dream. And now you're telling me we got to go to war against it and that's going to solve the problem? Yeah, well, we're going to build up a moderate force in Syria. Is that the policy you plan on inheriting from Barack Obama there, Rand? How about just come home? How about, this is how bad you've made it so far. You really want to make it worse? Because They're even talking about having John Bolton enter this thing. And the thing is about John Bolton is he's completely full of it, but he doesn't know that. And he's going to have Rand Paul for lunch. As Rand Paul goes, yeah, no, I know, you're totally right. No, you're totally right. Yeah, but weakness. What the hell kind of argument is that? Ron Paul, he stuttered a little bit. Whoa, Giuliani, I actually am feeling the pressure here. But let me just say that I learned the term blowback from the CIA guys. And where it came from was them predicting after they overthrew the Shah overthrew Mossadegh in favor of reinstalling the Shah Reza Pahlavi in 1953. They said in their own classified notes that we're going to have some blowback coming down the line from this one. Yep. The consequence has been playing out since, you might argue. I might. That's where it comes from. Consequences of secret foreign policy. So that when the consequences come, the American people are in the dark and liars like George Bush can say, well, they hate us because of how good we are. Not because of the mess my father got us into back at Operation Yellow Ribbon. Operation Lick Vietnam Syndrome. The Ledeen Doctrine in practice. Take a crappy little country and throw it up against the wall just to show we mean business. And then consequences are great because then we'll just mean more business. Nope, but Rand Paul can't tell the simple truth to a bunch of open-mouthed goons. No, they hate us because of how much they believe in their religion. Really? In 2015, that's the best one that you and your guys could come up with to say. Huh? What a crappy year for libertarianism it's going to be. You know, I'm happy to report that Joan Walsh, liberal PC enforcer at Salon.com, she wrote a thing saying, stop calling this guy a libertarian. He's not a libertarian. And she wasn't really trying to give us credit, I don't think, in a like very fair to us way. She's only got partisanship in mind that that's libertarianism is a good brand for a Republican to have. And it kind of might threaten the left a little. And so, no, he's a right-wing conservative. So I just chimed in immediately. Thank you. You're right. He is. That's exactly what he is he's a conservative. He's not a libertarian. And so, in this sense, I'm trying to care less, really. It's my own little psychological thing. I'm trying to care less about what Rand Paul says. The more people do not associate him with libertarianism, and the more they think of him as, oh, I get it. He really isn't like his dad. He really is just a conservative Republican. Okay, now I understand. Then the better off libertarianism's going to be. Because he's going to keep making us look bad, man. Because people don't, you know, they didn't read about it. A lot of people, they still think libertarianism means the Libertarian Party or something. You know, I don't know. Which it may or may not at any given time. Or actually probably wouldn't most of the time. At least on the national level. But the libertarian movement, you know, has a lot of things to it that the average Joe doesn't know that much about. And for them to learn about us through Rand Paul could, yeah, will be a real problem. Will continue to be a real problem, I think, probably. But Joan Walsh, at least, is telling her other fellow liberals and progressives that they should stop accusing him of being a libertarian because that would be the best thing about him. It's better to think of him as a right-wing conservative. So I hope that they take her messaging, you know, political partisan crap there, because it's also true. And it's also my partisan messaging thing. I don't want you calling yourself a libertarian in any way, because you're not. You suck. I'm sorry to waste a whole damn show talking about this. Let's talk about horrible wars that America caused. 1,700 bodies found into Crete mass grave. This is from the Speicher massacre. Remember Scott Speicher? He was shot down and killed in the first Gulf War. But then Ahmed Chalabi and the neocons and the liars pretended like they had intelligence that he's still alive. He's being held as a POW. That's one-fifth of the reason we've got to invade Iraq to free Scott Speicher. Spiker, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. You know, no offense intended. I think it's Speicher. And they named a base after him up there near Tikrit. After admitting the truth that he'd been dead for more than a decade. And anyway, this is where there had been a big massacre by the Islamic State of Shiite fighters from, I think it was their Air Force Academy. And they're digging up the mass graves there. 1,700 so far, I don't know. And then, yeah, at Yarmouk, the Islamic State is invading the Palestinian refugee camps outside of Damascus, on the western border of the Islamic State right now, too. Still. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. All right, so as you know, the news is that John Kerry worked out a deal with, Javad Zarif over there. And yeah, it's also the P5 plus one. The P5, that's the major powers of the earth, the allies of World War II. The United States, Britain, France, China, and Russia. They're the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. And then the plus one is our worst enemy at the time, the German Nazis. I mean, the Germans. And not that they're Nazis anymore. And anyway, so they are the P5. And they all have come to this agreement with Iran. But, of course, everyone knows it's America's dispute because that's what Israel wants, basically. But so they came to an agreement. And the Iranians pretty much capitulated across the board. Way expanded inspections beyond all reason to all kinds of things that have no direct bearing on the introduction of nuclear material to any machinery, like in the standard safeguards agreement with the IAEA. They're scaling back their enrichment at their main facility, and they're ending all enrichment, only experiments with non-nuclear, in their centrifuges at their secondary, much smaller nuclear facility. And in exchange, and for decades, and in exchange, the Americans are and the EU and the United Nations are lifting the sanctions. And it's a good damn deal. That's why Rand Paul is afraid. In fact, I'm sure he probably made a deal with Sheldon Adelson that I won't support it if you'll give me money, or at least not declare war on me the whole damn thing and not even give me a chance. So, kind of thing. I wouldn't doubt if they actually explicitly exchanged those terms and handshakes on it. But anyway. So Charles Schumer. Chuck Schumer. You know, I never did do it, but I remember the day that he got elected to the Senate that I meant to call just talk radio stations in New York and say, oh, thanks a lot, guys. That Al D'Amato, he was a scumbag, but this guy, Chuck Schumer, you're going to graduate him from the House up to the Senate? But he's such a bastard. You can't tell that. Now he's the minority leader incoming, minority leader of the Senate, most powerful Democrat in the Senate. And he's standing right up to the president and taking the war party's side on the Iran deal. So this thing is not over yet. It's still just a framework for an agreement. And it's a pretty specific framework. It's an outline, and it still needs an essay to fill it in, but still, it's a deal. But can the Republicans and the Democrats scotch this thing with the help of Rand Paul and his counterpart, Chuck Schumer? Yeah, they could. The Israel lobby could kill this thing yet. Wouldn't that be something? Now, I will say that Netanyahu had said, well, the deal should have recognition of Israel in it. And Obama just slapped that down and said, his answer was funny. He said, well, listen, if they weren't such bad guys, we wouldn't be in this controversy in the first place. our nuclear deal takes into account the horrible anti-Semitic nature of the Iranian regime. So making them start being nice guys, that kind of is, in, you know, is contrary to the entire premise of that we're working with here. It's just some double talk, but it worked, I guess. Good enough for me. It's, in other words, it's a slap down with all due respect. That's not going to have anything to do with this, so forget it. But then yesterday, and this is the top story at antiwar.com right now, I think, in the news, is that there's this piece by Hannah Alam and Joel Greenberg at McClatchy. White House defends Iran deal as Israel, Saudi Arabia soften their positions. And now, don't get me wrong, we're not talking that much softer. However, check out what it is, though. Remember on Sunday, Diane Feinstein even slapped Netanyahu down. He did every Sunday morning news show, I guess, most of them. And Feinstein said, oh, I wish he would just, basically hush up. Contain himself, she said. That's what it was. I wish he would contain himself because for all his complaining, I haven't heard him explain what a better deal might look like when this one seems pretty good to me. And so then that's where he came up with this nonsense about they have to recognize Israel as part of this deal. But now the next day, yesterday, they came out and they said, get this. This should be built on hard-nosed requirements in terms of limitations on what they do at various timescales on the access and transparency. Whoa! Climb down. Israel on Monday listed a set of changes it seeks in the final agreement, including ending research and development work on advanced centrifuges, closing the underground facility at Fordo, disclosing past nuclear developments that could have military dimensions, and allowing inspectors to go anywhere, anytime, to verify the accord. Well, that's easy, because check it out. The ending research and development work on advanced centrifuges and the closing of Fordo, that's the same thing, pretty much, that they're asking there, because Fordo is where all, at least much of, the experimenting will be going on, and that's just not going to happen, and so, okay, you're going to have to give up that one. The next one is disclosing their past nuclear developments that could have military dimensions. Key buzzword, possible military dimensions. But those are all bogus and easy to disprove, and much of it already has been disproven. The alleged smoking laptop or alleged studies, the possible military dimensions, these are the same things. And a couple of other accusations, I guess, tacked on. But none of it's true. The whole thing's been completely debunked already. And really, here's how I got a minute. The warhead they supposedly were designing, the delivery vehicle they were supposedly designing, wouldn't have fit any kind of nuclear warhead that they could possibly make. And there's no other evidence that such a thing existed anywhere in Iran. And it's for a previous generation of missile that the forgers didn't know was being replaced by a new generation that was being done in secret at the time, but which exists now, and which made it seem highly unlikely they would have been designing the warhead for a lesser missile, the one that was replaced and taken out of service. And then you had the Green Salt Project, where they're supposedly enriching uranium with lasers up to uranium tetrafluoride. That's five fluorides tied to the uranium. But for what? They can already go at their Isfahan reactor right in front of everybody, or probably in secret, I guess, if they needed to, because they didn't have constant inspections there. But they could already go from refined yellowcake uranium up to uranium hexafluoride gas, which is what you need to put it in the centrifuge in much greater quantities than you could ever get with the laser enrichment, which, as described in the documents, is just some bench-level thought experimenting kind of thing anyway. It was never part of any kind of program. And then you had the forged documents about the uranium mines that attempted to make it look like it was under the authority of the military when it was not. Virtually all of this is debunked by Gareth Porter. He's certainly your first source for all this stuff. But Gordon Prather had cast a lot of doubt. And by the way, they admitted it. I mean, Ali Heinen admitted the documents came from the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, which means they're a front for the Israeli intelligence, funneling the documents. That was their origin in the first place. There was no laptop. They made up the laptop later. They just had the files and then put it on one and said, oh, look, a smoking laptop. Ali Hynen and the hawk at the IAEA said, well, you know, we actually don't know where a lot of this comes from. Yeah, no, really, huh? And anyway, on down the line. Then the Parchin experiments, again debunked by Gareth Porter and by Robert Kelly, the former IAEA inspector or director of some level. I don't know. Anyway, nonsense. And then the snap inspections, I think that's going to be in there anyway. So that's the Israelis really climbing down. Sorry for the tangent, but just so you know. You know, that PMD stuff is nonsense. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, you guys, welcome back. So now, I guess it is just the last segment of the show. I've been putting this off, mostly I've just been spacing out and forgetting it. But somebody asked me, hey, where's a really good listicle kind of an article? I'm putting words in his mouth, but basically this is what he's getting to. Where's a good article I can read that just goes down the list of all the crazy militias in the Middle East and who all's on whose side and that kind of thing? And, man, I am like the third-hand-ish expert here. I know just enough to tell you, but not necessarily enough to be completely right about all this or whatever. But anyway, it seems to me not too difficult. You know, I don't know. The Gulf is ruled by kings and emirs and sultans. They're all Sunnis, and they're all backed by the United States. And then Saudi Arabia. Yemen is in question right now. There's a war going on. But that Saudi, UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, and Oman. And did I say Kuwait there? Yeah. And then, so they all have, you know, monopoly kingdoms that rule there. In Yemen, you have a battle going on right now between the Houthis, who are kind of Shiite, although they've always prayed right with the Sunni and whatever, haven't had that division. But anyway, they're right now working with the ex-dictator who used to attack them all the time. Even though apparently he's one of them, but when he was the dictator, he waged war against them. But he's still got army divisions loyal to him, and they're fighting a war against the new guy that America replaced him with for PR purposes back in 2011. And it was really the people of Yemen replaced him, because the guy's a horrible bastard, and he was a worse horrible bastard, of course, because of all the money and power and guns that the Americans had given him in the name of fighting Al-Qaeda. Letting America drone bomb the place and create more Al-Qaeda, of course, is more like it. But anyway. Then you have Iraq, which is now ruled from Baghdad down to Kuwait by the Shiite parties, the Dawa Party, and I guess the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution has just, they've kind of renamed themselves a few times, but it's still basically the same United Iraqi Alliance that won the purple-fingered election of 2005 and that America fought an eight-year civil war for against the Sunnis, and in alliance, of course, with Iran to the east. And so you have what's left of their army is at now, they're saying like maybe 20, 30,000 guys is their entire army after George Bush spent all those hundreds of billions of dollars, so-called, building it up for them. And most of their fighters apparently would rather, by the hundreds of thousands, would rather fight in these militias such as the Badr Brigade, which really had made up the core of the army anyway. But I guess depends on what's the easier way to get paid. But the Badr Brigade, they're at their core, their leadership are the guys who fled Iraq to Iran back when Jimmy Carter had Saddam invade Iran in 1980. And, or gave him the green light in 80, 81, I guess. Yeah, 80, I think he started. Anyway, right after the Iranian Revolution, these guys were, they didn't stay in Iraq. They went, and not that they really owed Saddam allegiance, but anyway, they fled to Iran and fought on Iran's side in the war. And so their entire brigade, their Badr Corps, was, you know, built up and trained in Iran. And they came in on the heels of the American war, and, you know, the Americans found out after the fact that this was who they were really fighting for all along. Bush made a deal with them pretty quickly, although I don't know if he really understood what it was that they represented, the Supreme Islamic Council guys. But anyway, so that's the biggest and most powerful of the Shiite militias is the Badr Brigade, and then there are other breakoffs of them, and there's the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr, and he and his father had stayed in Iraq. I don't know if their guys fought in the Iran-Iraq war, but anyway, they had stayed there and had a lot more street credibility than the Supreme Islamic Council ever had, but had a lot less money and a lot less stature as far as the Americans were concerned. They would never deal with Sadr, and he never really wanted to deal with them either. And so he was a thorn in their side. At the same time, America was fighting for Muqtada al-Sadr and his group and their power in Baghdad and the rest of Iraq against the Sunni-based insurgency. They would often pick fights with him and fight him too, just because he wouldn't fall in line and do exactly what they want. And they ended up making him, they accused him of being the one who was tied to Iran when he was the Iraqi nationalist who wanted to kick Iran and America out and form an alliance with the Sunnis, based on Iraqi nationalism and not sectarianism. And so they accused him of being the Iranian-backed one, and actually ended up even chasing him into Iran, where he became, of course, more Iranian-backed. And then they say that this group, Asaib al-Al-Haq, is a break-off. That's one of the so-called special groups, a break-off, more Iranian-backed and trained than Sadr's Mahdi army. And then they have their counterparts in Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and in the various militias that are helping the Shiites and the Alawites fight the civil war in Syria as well. And that's basically makes up the Shiite crescent there. It does go down into northeastern Saudi Arabia, where all the oil happens to be as well. There's a Shiite population, Saudi, oppressed by the American king there. And anyway, so that's the so-called Shiite crescent, is Iran, Iraq from Baghdad down to Kuwait anyway, and then what's left of the rump state of Syria from the Mediterranean to Damascus and Aleppo and et cetera. And then Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and it's called the Shiite crescent. It was named that by the king of Jordan, the American sock puppet Hashemite king of Jordan, Abdullah, named it that after George Bush invaded Iraq, imported the Iranian Revolution that Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan had, and George Bush's father, Sr., in the 80s, had supported Saddam to contain. And so then, in 2007, you can read Seymour Hersh all about that. The article is called The Redirection. And I actually should reread it. It's been a little while. But the basic point of the thing is that, oops, we're a bunch of stupid idiots, and we just imported the Iranian Revolution that Reagan and Bush Sr. and Jimmy Carter before them had hired Saddam Hussein to contain for us. And so now we need to redirect back toward our Saudi allies who've been financing the Sunni-based insurgency against us in Iraq for the past 5 years. And they said, and so what we'll do is we'll help support Mujahideen groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and others in Syria against Assad. And we'll, you know, hope to build up a Sunni awakening movement that will end up ruling Sunnistan in Iraq. Work with bin Ladenite groups like Fatah al-Islam in Lebanon and Jandala in eastern Iran. And we'll, you know, basically we're switching back to the Sunnis after accidentally fighting a war for Tehran for the last 6 years, 8 years. And, well, by then four, but anyway, it was to continue for a while there. And then, they had their awakening movement in Iraq, but they never were. The benchmarks were never met. The awakening movement was never invited in to join the government in any kind of democratic coalition type situation, as they'd sold the war at all. The Shiites told them, hey, the Americans gave us the capital city, and that's all we want. We don't want Fallujah and Mosul and Tikrit. You guys can have them. Screw you. But you're not getting any oil money from us. You're not getting anything from us. And so they rioted, and so they were shot, and so they were driven into the arms of the Islamic State, which, as of 2011, when the Arab Spring broke out, you had America trying to decide what to do after their sock puppet Mubarak and Ben Ali before him were overthrown in Egypt and in Tunisia. And so they sacrificed Gaddafi basically for a PR stunt, even though George Bush had brought him in from the cold. Hillary decided that she was going to go ahead and get rid of him anyway, and that was what the French really wanted, too. So Obama went ahead and did it, and this is a true thing, man. You got to read this series in the Washington Times about it, and I found some Josh Rogan and others reporting this, too, I think confirming it, that you actually had a meeting in the White House where you had the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who I think was Dempsey at the time, the National Security Advisor, Donilon or Danilion or whatever. I never heard anybody say it before. The Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the National Security Advisor, his deputy, they're all on one side. Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice, and Samantha Power on the other, saying, oh, we got to do it, Mr. President. And he sided with them, with the Secretary of State, with the Deputy National Security Advisor. I don't know. What was Susan Rice at the time? Oh, she was the ambassador to the UN. And then Samantha Power was just the deputy assistant secretary of do-gooder, rinky-dink stuff, as she called it, on the National Security Council. Stuff like, you know, integrating the Iraqi Sunnis into the government. Responsibilities like that. And they convinced Obama to do this war, which was directly on behalf, and we called the score in real time the whole time in 2011, that this is all in favor of the Libyan members of al-Qaeda in Iraq, the guys who just fought with Zarqawi and for the Sunni-based insurgency against our guys when we were fighting for the Badr Corps. And here they are, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and Ansar al-Sharia, and they go, yeah, we are loyal to bin Laden. I met him. Yeah, we fought side by side in Afghanistan. I fought for Zarqawi in Iraq, too. But we really appreciate your help getting rid of Gaddafi for us. That was in the Telegraph, for Christ's sake. It was in the Telegraph. It was in the Sunday Times. Hey, look, here's a big boat full of Libyan fighters and guns and money on its way to Syria, where America... Now I'm over time. The show's over, and I didn't hear the bumper music playing. But anyway, to wrap this thing up without looking at the clock, and then they supported what became the Mujahideen civil war in Syria, too, with Jabhat al-Nusra. And eventually the Islamic State, and through their allies and slightly plausible deniability, and probably about 1/3 stupidity and 2/3 mendacity. So now you know.